On today's episode of Animation Deliberation, we're covering episode 5 of Amazon Prime's Invincible, titled That Actually Hurt. Stay tuned for that, right after these ads that don't necessarily reflect the views of the host or the network. Sing along if you know the words. A 1, 2, 3, it's time for Animation Deliberation, a conversation and a celebration of our favorite action animated series, yeah. Alright folks, welcome back to another episode of Animation Deliberation. I'm your host, J. Scotty St. Clair, and I'm joined by my co-host, Zuhair Ali. What's up, Zuhair?
Same old. How about you?
Doing good, right on. And joining us again from our previous coverage of the first 4 episodes is Mr. Nathaniel Muzzy. How you doing, buddy?
Great, thanks for having me. Feeling pretty lucky to live in a time where every Friday I get episodes of Invincible and Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Yes, indeed. It is quite a time to be alive if you're a fan of not only just comic book stuff, but animation in particular, because as I mentioned, you know, as we pontificated upon with these first few episodes, this is an awesome show. We're loving it. And that continued right into this 5th episode, aptly named That Actually Hurt. So I'm excited to get into it. If you guys want to just go ahead and give like your initial thoughts, I will go ahead and give an overall spoiler warning. But if you guys want to just give your initial thoughts and opinions, feel free, whoever wants to take the floor.
So I just want to add real quick that My Hero Academia comes out on Saturdays as well. So for me, it's a whole trifecta. In the morning, I get Falcon and the Winter Soldier. In the evening time, I get Invincible and then wake up to My Hero the next day. Superhero galore.
Yep. Zuhair has been planting little seeds. So if you like My Hero Academia, just be patient. Stay tuned. We will definitely be covering that as well. So
blow up our email at animationdeliberation@gmail.com so that we can speed up the process of recording this show as well.
Sounds good. J. Scotty here, just got to hop in with a quick correction. That email is actually animationdeliberationpodcast@gmail.com. So don't sweat it, Zuhair. That's what I'm here for. I got you, bud.
But in regards to the show that we are talking about today, I was actually just texting with my buddy talking about how like this felt very much like a filler episode for a majority of it. Like, you get a little bit of the investigation stuff going on and a few things of just kind of like the rom-com aspect of it, the relationship with Omni-Man and Mark, and just kind of how it's going. And then we were covering a lot of another character. What was his name? Titan?
Yes.
Yeah, Titan's so we correct. Get like, yep. We got like a lot of his story, so I was like, why are we covering so much about somebody who just got his ass beat in the first episode? But as the episode went on and the development of everything, it got more insane and intense, and we got what I believe is a really cool villain in Machine Head, who seems like a mix of a Black Mask and Ultron.
Definitely Black Mask vibes. Yeah.
So yeah, it escalated pretty well. The action towards this ending was insane, and I'm sure we have a lot to say about that. So let's hear your thoughts, Muzzy, before I dive into that and miss your opinion.
Yeah. So I guess from I get where you're coming from when you say it felt like a filler episode at first, but I actually thought it was one of the best episodes we've gotten so far. We get to see, you know, they touch on issues of race, they touch on issues of privilege. We get the introduction of Battle Beast, and Titan's storyline is, you know, clearly a Luke Cage storyline.
Yep.
But at the same time, it oddly, you know, you know, we gave a spoiler warning, but it ends with Titan kind of taking Machine Head's old role.
Yeah.
But what's weird to me about that is that's how the Luke Cage series ended on season 2.
Yeah.
So it's literally just the Luke Cage TV series story in a lot of ways.
And it's worth mentioning this character Titan is actually portrayed by an actor that was on Luke Cage. He portrayed Copperhead, or was it Cottonmouth, excuse me.
Cottonmouth, yes.
Yeah, Cottonmouth, Mahershala Ali, so. And
who is awesome in everything he does.
Yeah. Not to get too off track here, but while we're on the subject of some of his body of work, I I like him a lot in Alita Battle Angel. He didn't have the biggest role in that, and some people might say he was underutilized, but I love that film, and I could talk about that film for a long time if you guys let me. But
this is not the first time this week he's mentioned it either.
There you go. But no, I do like the fact that you bring up all the different themes that were touched on, because yeah, there were some scenes that were a little more obvious, and then there were the ones that were a little more subtle. And I really did like that discussion where Invincible's talking to Titan about teaming up in the first place, and Invincible doesn't even know who Machine Head is because, you know, he just doesn't have that perspective. Not only is he a rich kid from the suburbs, but just given his own power set and his inheritance in a way, we already talked about, you know, Omni-Man kind of looking down on humanity. We see that a little bit from Invincible, so... I definitely appreciated some of those more nuanced aspects as well. And then another thing, you kind of mentioned the filler aspect as well, but I appreciated the montages a little bit, because not only did they demonstrate the parallels between these characters and Mark and Titan, it also showed us how comfortable Mark has become in his powers, you know. Those first couple episodes, just every time he took off to fly and land, it was such a struggle for him, and now he seems so confident. It's nice to kind of be able to spend time with him, and now he's found his groove.
We see him in space a lot more now, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he stops an asteroid.
A little asteroid.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What, Omni-Man says the one he stopped a couple of years ago was the size of Texas?
Ugh.
And that seems to be kind of an ongoing thing with Omni-Man during this training, and is like, no matter what Mark does, there is always like a backhanded compliment.
Ooh,
you okay. know, it's always, that was good, but I did this, you mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's just insecurity from Omni-Man, if it's part of, you know, Omni-Man's motivations for killing the Guardians. Like, I'm still trying to piece that together.
Yeah, yeah, we did talk about how, like, Mark, his powers manifesting seemed to be a catalyst for Omni-Man, you know, taking certain actions, and chief among those being killing the Guardians of the Globe. But, yeah, he definitely, as much as he seems to have dedicated himself to Mark's training and wants Mark to take it seriously. He mentions not only at the dinner scene that, you know, this is a lesson you're going to have to learn the hard way. He goes out and shows that he's just not afraid to let Mark learn that lesson the hard way, because we've already kind of alluded to the really gory action scene that we get towards the end here with that character Battle Beast. But Omni-Man knew that was going on and chose not to intervene and let Mark.
Yeah, you see him in the background and... yeah, and it kind of makes you wonder, you know, how strong Battle Beast is, although Battle Beast teleports away at the end, so maybe we don't get an answer to that soon, but...
We didn't get an incredible amount of dialogue from Battle Beast, but I think he mentioned something along the lines, like, he was told that there were warriors worthy of his ability, so maybe he's referring to Omni-Man?
Well, he... Yeah, that's what I don't know, you know, unclear of what Battle Beast's motivations are, other than he seems to be looking for a worthy opponent, so I guess you know, we've seen characters like that in all kinds of media, but, you know, assuming it takes some time to travel to Earth for him, although he seems to be able to teleport, so, again, unclear, but, like, the original Guardians are gone too. Omni-Man didn't fight him, so, you know, he gets put up against this mismatched team of new Guardians,
right,
and Invincible, and kind of I guess if he was looking for, you know, a foe that could challenge him, he certainly didn't find it among them.
No, he didn't. He lays waste to pretty much everyone, and doesn't seem to be too much of a struggle for him.
Yeah, did he kill Samson, or did they live?
Unclear. I was under the impression towards the end. I mean, obviously when the action was happening, I thought several key members got taken out, but we already saw where was it, at the, like, the cleanup of the original Guardians massacre, I think with the character of Immortal. We still don't know where that's going, but obviously this world has some really advanced medical techniques. And then it was also showcased when Invincible tried to save that woman that didn't end up making it, but we saw the advanced medical capabilities. So I think Black Samson might still be in it, but I honestly don't see how he could have survived what he went through.
I'm not sure if he'll be on the team much longer. He might be on injury reserve for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But in regards to what you were saying about Omni-Man's intentions, you mentioned, like, towards the end regarding, like, testing what he's capable of, and just kind of, I feel like Omni-Man's approach is just kind of like a very know your place
That's
type
fair.
Approach where, okay. like, there is a bit of, like, fatherly training and, like, I want you to be good and I want you to do this and do that, but then there's the jealousy aspect that we were talking about last week in regards to, like, I'm still fucking better than you and you need to remember that. I will always, like, remind you that I will always be better than you because I'm 100%.
He seems like that dad who won't let their kid beat him at basketball.
Totally. Yeah, totally.
You know, like it's strange to see who is, as far as we know, the most powerful hero, so insecure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it feels like, is he's super insecure about Mark.
Yeah.
Like, and that's why he always has to, like, you know, when Mark succeeds, he compliments Mark and then reminds Mark that, oh, I'm still the best.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's true. I was beating myself up last week about forgetting to say this on the cast. But it looks like Omni-Man's species seems to have their powers fully developed when they grow a full mustache. So maybe he's just stopping his son from growing his.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So
notice when he was, like, talking about, like, his home planet, like, every, like, male that was in the hero role, like, had, like, a full stash.
Okay, so
that's an interesting observation, and I wouldn't put it past them that the mustache is important.
Yes.
So that's just one more reason to hate the Joss Whedon version of Justice League. Had they kept the mustache in for the reshoots, we would have had our first Viltrumite on screen.
Superman would have been so much more powerful.
I did want to take this opportunity to backpedal a little bit. We were kind of talking about, you know, the parallels between Titan as well as Mark, given those, like, vignettes and those montages. But as comfortable as Mark has, you know, stepped into this role as a superhero, and we see him succeed in a lot of ways, he does start to have a bit of a falling out in his personal life with his time management, with his relationship with Amber. And then on the opposite side of things, that we also see that, you know, Titan is not a straight up villain. He's not just a thug. He's kind of muscle for hire, and he's indebted, and he has people in his life that he cares very much about. And his daughter specifically has connection to Amber and her volunteer work. So,
yeah.
I mean, we talked about last week with the shipping aspect of the conversation of why I didn't feel Amber and Mark would make a good couple. And this episode helped my answer for that question. Because we see, like you just mentioned, the time management is an issue with the training and school and being a hero and all that stuff. And it just kind of showed that, like, they didn't have enough of a connection or enough of a bond beforehand to actually, like, justify, that level of space and time that he's not able to provide.
It kind of comes to me that, like, I feel bad for Amber, because, like, clearly she's invested in this, and in a lot of ways she's a better person than Mark is. Not that Mark's a bad guy.
Sure.
But, like, she goes out of her way to help others, mm-hmm. and, like, you kind of see her reinvesting herself in the community. And she is kind of, like, in a way, like, if Omni-Man is the devil on Mark's shoulder, she's kind of the angel on his shoulder.
Hmm.
But, like, she's paying an emotional price for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of tough to see, because she is such a thoughtful and caring character, and you can tell she's hurting and doesn't really understand why Mark is treating her this way. But, you know, she does appreciate the things that he does do. And she even mentions it, you know, the little notes, the picking up sushi, the going out of the way. And, I did appreciate the fact that, part of what helped reaffirm and reassure their relationship, even though we obviously leave the episode with Mark kind of, incapacitated and her not knowing where he is, it was her interactions with Adam Eve that, you know, anytime you're dealing with like teenage characters and love triangles, it's really easy to kind of like go into that, those tropes of them kind of, I hate to, you know, I, for some reason I'm thinking of the Archie universe. We've got, you know, Archie, Betty, and Veronica is a trope for a reason, but I'm yeah. glad that they don't go that direction with it. The fact that these two have a conversation, they almost seem to have, you know, just as much in common as Mark has with Amber, or as, as Mark has with Amber and Amber has with Mark and Mark has with Eve. Yeah.
I really like that dynamic, and I like that they didn't just make the female characters fawning over Mark and disliking each other because they both like Mark. And I do think on some level, maybe they both do like Mark, but like,
Adam Eve is respecting the space.
Exactly. Like, and I like that about this show is they're not making the female characters catty towards each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not fighting over a boy. Like, they're more developed and they have more going on in their lives than just Mark.
Yeah. But you mentioned how Amber might be the angel on Mark's shoulder, where Omni-Man's the devil. As soon as you said that, though, I couldn't help but think of that dinner scene where he's bringing up, you know, the potential plan to team up with Titan, and Omni-Man is very much against it, where Deborah, I would say, is also more the angel on his shoulder, and the fact that she's kind of keeping him anchored to his humanity. We talked previously how Amber serves that role as well, as much as there is the relationship with Mark and his two parents where one ties him back to his humanity. We kind of have the same thing in his relationships with these, I won't call them both paramours, because I do think it's kind of refreshing to see a nice and solid friendship between Eve and Mark, and even though there is the potential for romance there, it is just kind of nice to see that they, you know, we talked about it last episode, it's kind of reversed this time around. Like, he asks her, does she need to talk, and she's immediately like, yes, and then backpedals. But I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here. We should, while we're talking about Adam Eve, we should talk about some of the things that she went through and some of the revelations we got with her character. She's, you know, coming off the last stuff she dealt with, Rex cheating on her, and you would think her parents would be in support of her moving on from that, but we find her home life is a pretty toxic situation.
Yeah, I hate to throw it out there, but her parents kind of reminded me of like a typical Asian household too.
Oh, and,
but Asian, I mean like my sub Asian as well. Not speaking out of my realm here. But there was.
I didn't mean for my reaction to indicate that. I was just.
For any other listeners, just kind of like, I'm speaking out of like somewhat experience or like, you know, firsthand witness as well. But there was kind of the vibe of like, oh, we only let you do this because the guy was watching over you, and like, oh, we didn't want you to do this anyway, so we're just so happy that you're out of this situation and you're home with us. And there's a very like, we made you, so we want to control your actions type of deal, and it looked like they tried to like let her go through her phase, but now it's just kind of like, okay, you had your fun, you're back home now. Man, I did not like her parents one bit. Like, she's even talking about the fact like, dude, like, I got hurt, I lost my team, my boyfriend cheated on me, like, why are you guys not being the least bit empathetic right now? Like, I'm in a lot of pain right now and you guys are not making it any better. And dude, I felt for her. I'm surprised she didn't run out faster or shrink the whole house before she dipped.
Yeah, her parents are super misogynistic.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, and like that's something, you know, I the scene's uncomfortable because, you know, I don't know, like, it's always uncomfortable when you see, like, a teenage character with, like, a rough home life. But, like, I was proud of this show for, like, tackling issues of misogyny and, like, her mom with a lot of internalized misogyny. Mm-hmm. When, you know, their daughter can literally restructure matter. At least that's what she says.
Yeah.
And that's not enough because she's not a boy. I mean, she's easily more powerful than Rexplosion from what we've seen so far.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah.
She's arguably the strongest person on the teen team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just kind of, it kind of puts to light, yeah, for some people, it doesn't matter how strong you are if you're a girl. And, like, unfortunately, that's, her parents are coming with that. And, like, you know, it's interesting to see from a cartoon especially that they're willing to tackle that.
Mm-hmm, yeah. The show kind of, it is good that they tackle it, and I guess it's kind of played very well because the scene feels almost dated and kind of archaic because I guess that's because those ideals and those viewpoints are. But I love the end of that scene, like, as much as you're like, you get that trope of like, don't you slam that door, young lady. It's like, don't you leave that door there, because she basically created the door and there wasn't a door there before.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, this whole episode deals a lot with privilege and mm-hmm. intersectionality, mm-hmm. you know, because we see how Adam Eve is treated as a woman. We see how Titan is treated as a black man.
Mm-hmm.
And we see how Amber is dealing with things as a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we also see a mixed household, Mark's household. Nolan is, for intents and purposes, he's Viltrumite, but he's a white man.
Sure.
And, you know, we see his Asian wife kind of appalled that he could consider, like, the plight of Titan below them.
Yeah.
And she, you know, she basically says she had to teach her white husband how to care about people who weren't like him mm-hmm. when he first came to the planet. And, you know, this episode really kind of tackles a lot of issues.
It does, yeah.
One of the big ones was when Omni-Man was just convinced, it's kind of like, why does he need to save one person? We're talking about saving thousands of people. But it's like, one person means something to hundreds, if not thousands of people. So, like a life is a life. If you have the opportunity to do something to better somebody else's life, like, why would you not take that chance? Like, what? It's not taking anything away from you. Like, is he wasting his time by, you know, getting the cat out of the tree or stopping a burglar or anything of that sort? Like, how is it beneath him? He has the opportunity to help.
Yeah, and that's kind of the interesting question of it, is it's literally making us look at the ethical question of, is it better to save one life or to save millions? And, you know, do you have to prioritize, or do you just do good when you can do good?
Right, right. It does bring that ethical question up to us as viewers, but I can't help but think that for Omni-Man, it's not really a question, you know. Yes, he does see things on a larger scale and sees what his potential is, but I don't think his intentions are, you know, to save the most amount of people because that's the right thing to do. I think he wants to save the most amount of people because that's what'll bring him the most, acclaim or be the best showcasing of his power, I guess, for lack of a better way of explaining that. I don't think he's altruistic in his motivations.
I think one of my favorite scenes, it's kind of irrelevant, but it just made me laugh thinking about it, was when Titan was on the roof and it was like, he was trying to paint Invincible. And he's like, you left a couple letters there, but it was like, paint's expensive and you got a long ass name.
yeah. And like, you know, like the idea that like a supervillain doesn't have the money to buy paint.
Right.
Like, you know, like privilege and money and power, you know, money is power even amongst the super criminals. And yeah, it's I thought it was super funny too, but like, it is making a point.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh shit, you made that very real just now.
Yeah, that one was played a little more for laughs, but then when we actually see the family for the first time and they kind of play the scene a little menacing, you think he's like infiltrating another house to do something nefarious, and he actually surprises his daughter with mm-hmm. the butterscotch ice cream, and she goes, oh, dad got my text, and then the wife's like, oh, that means we still have service, which just shows how indebted they are to Machine Head. Machine Head controls whether or not their phones are on or off.
So the first half of that was really cute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But while we bring up Machine Head, it is a good opportunity to kind of talk about him, but you referred to him as a Black Mass character, and I did want to point out that Jeffrey Donovan voices him, and they do a lot of auto-tuning on there, but he's one of those villains that it's just, you relish hating, because as much as we were getting, you know, these themes of classism, he is very much that Sionis privileged, live life with a silver spoon. And we get the joke a couple of times when Titan slams the desk out of frustration. That was imported Italian maple. And then later on, when they bust through the door, and he was prepared for it because of the quantum computing he's capable of, because of the chip Titan got for him, again, that door was imported Italian maple.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you got your debt back.
I kind of love that, like, for all his love of expensive things, the door and desk are the same material. Like, he's got no creativity. Yeah. It's just...
It's got to match, Muzzy.
Well,
and as we've learned, international shipping is a bitch.
Oh, yeah.
That it is. I talked about how Machine Head was prepared, and we've already kind of alluded to Battle Beast and this crazy, gruesome action set piece that goes down there at the end. But let's just go ahead and get right into it. So initially, it is Invincible and Titan taking on, who is it, Battle Beast. We've got this character that basically has these elastic controllable bands that seem to come out of his chest. There's a person that's made out of lava, for lack of a better description, a robot character, and then the return of that electrical speedster character that we saw Red Rush combat in the first episode. So Invincible seems to, you know, be able to hold his own initially, but Battle Beast is just a force to be reckoned with, which we've already kind of described. So it requires the new Guardians team to come in. And we learn that they are very much still working out the kinks. And I guess before that, we kind of got the little scene with them where they were celebrating and having a debriefing.
Yep.
Which was,
Samson kind of tells them, hey, you know, we did all this damage, and... Did he say that there were civilians hurt?
Yeah, like, I think it was, like, few in the hospital in Fidno, like, what, 20?
Two dozen, I think he says. Two dozen, yeah. Hospitalized. Okay.
Yeah.
I did like the breakdown as a tactician, though. Like, Rex kind of is flippant, like, what could I have done about it? And he's like, well, this is what you do. You break up the ground, you blow the tires, and then that gives Monster Girl the ability to slow down the bus and save the people.
But then he even mentioned that, like, they were too busy, like, competing with each other. I'm like, I'll beat up more than you do.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, I love the way that scene was put together so much. Because, I mean, like you said, like, they were all, like, happy and competitive. Because that's what they did when they were, like, the number 4 and number 5 ranked team. But now it's like, oh, because we're the Guardians of the Globe, like, just because we made the team, like, we're instantly as good as them. And think people think as highly of us, and we're awesome. And it's like, no, you guys fucking suck today. Yeah. Like, sure, you, like, won the day, but, like, at what cost?
Yep.
Yeah, and the disrespect they give Samson for not having powers.
Batman would have never taken that.
Yeah, I mean, he makes some really good points, and it all falls on deaf ears, except for Robot. And as they're all kind of walking away and blowing them off, Samson's like, "Can you believe these guys?" And then it lingers on Robot, and he looks to Monster Girl, and he says, "Some of them." So I think that's interesting. We talked about it on the last episode. The one interaction that they really had together was Robot kind of confiding in her and telling Monster Girl that he understands what it's like to be seen for something than what you actually are on the inside. And she kind of blew him off, but that didn't really seem to deter him. I don't know if they're romantic feelings or what, but Robot obviously has a very strong interest and affinity for Monster Girl.
Yeah, I'm also not sure, like, what Robot's motivations are. It kind of seems like he's romantically interested in her,
mm-hmm.
and I guess she is 25, but it still feels a little creepy, because I guess he's a robot. Who knows how old he is,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, and he says that after she says she's the only one who lost anything in the battle.
Right.
Because she lost, she's like a week younger.
Yes.
Yeah, so.
I kind of wondered how that worked. So if she progresses a week younger and then just decides not to use her powers for like 3 years, will she get 3 years older? I mean,
yeah, I believe so.
Okay, interesting.
Which makes me wonder if that time-displaced alien race,
ooh,
like, will, like, if they can take her there and age her up again, and then, like...
Ooh, that's really interesting. I hadn't even considered that. That's a great...
They probably want a trade-off of some kind of recruitment, though.
Yeah.
Well, Omni-Man pretty much destroyed their civilization.
That's true.
So, I don't know if they're there to do anything about it.
Yeah, that's fair.
But I didn't quite see it as romantic feelings. I just figured that, like, there's kind of the relationship of, like, how do I explain this? I mean, for the first part, it's, I think he feels like she can relate the most because she's the only one where, like, the world sees Monster Girl, but, like, she has this conflict of knowing her identity but not being able to, like, really get it out there. And that's how Robot feels as well, in the sense of, like, everyone thinks he's just a robot, but there actually is an identity. And throughout the last fight, we see him, like, depict a lot of emotion, too. Like, actually fighting out of, like, anger and fear and very revenge-driven and whatnot. So I didn't see it as romantic as much of, like, she was the only one that had the potential to, like, be empathetic towards him. And then because of her age, his, like, hero nature was just kind of, like, the protective vibe, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that could be it.
It was more nurturing than it was anything else.
I was just going to say, Robot is just, like, next to Omni-Man, he's, like, the character, like, I'm most interested in seeing, like, what is this guy actually up to?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, we got some more context to that in this episode with that scene with the Mahler twins. We know that he was the benefactor that released them from prison previously, and we actually get to see the cloning process come full circle. I think it was the previous episode they got the meat from the Burger Mart, which is kind of funny that the Mahler twins are made out of Burger Mart meat. But we actually see, like, the body mature. And then we see the transfer of the consciousness, which I guess it's just kind of like a facsimile of the existing consciousness. And that's why we learn there's this constant bickering about which one is the original. And as soon as they start up, Robot steps out of the shadows and is like, oh, I'll never understand why you two do that.
Yeah. And he wants he needs their cloning expertise. Mm-hmm. Have we seen him take blood from anyone other than Rex?
I don't believe so.
So are we assuming he's cloning Rex for some reason?
Seems to be going that way, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know where that's going. One Rex is kind of obnoxious enough for me, but presumably his clone won't have Rex's mind. But
I think that's what I wanted to get to, is that I feel like he just wants to make a body and he likes Rex's powers, and that's a power he probably want with like his mental skill set.
Oh,
interesting.
Also, we saw Rex and Monster Girl kind of hit it off after their fight a little bit.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that has something to do with it.
Maybe that nurture versus romance is more poignant than we think, and he's actually seeking a host that she would find physically appealing. I could see that. The other thing I took away from that scene, though, is and forgive me, I don't have the exact dialogue here, but Robot refers to the regenerative properties of the Mahler twins' cells. And it seems like whatever his previous plans were, he might have to pivot and use whatever he's got to help heal Monster Girl, because last we see, I was certain she was dead when we saw Battle Beast take those two rocks and slam her monster skull between the two. But the last we saw her, she's on a breathing apparatus, and he mentioned she's on a defibrillator. A lot of tough words today.
Yeah, very Hulk-like.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm just curious, like, part of me wants Robot to be good and, like, just be thinking, like, several steps ahead. But, yeah, it's hard to know.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, who ended up with the quantum chip that was Machine Head had?
Cecil, I think.
Okay, yeah. Cecil got it.
It did seem that way.
And then at the very end, we also see Cecil's Agent Coulson. I don't know his name. I apologize.
Let me get it real quick. Yeah.
Experimenting with Mark's blood.
Chris? Oh, no. Donald Ferguson.
Okay.
Ferguson. I'm sure by the last episode of this series, I will know his name. And then I will forget it by next season.
But they're experimenting on the blood that they were able to collect from Mark when he, you know, because Mark, they're still saying that he's touch and go right now. They don't know if he's going to make it. I mean, I'm pretty confident because we know this is an adaptation. It's a long running comic series. I think Mark's going to be okay. I mean, this might be a defining character moment for him in terms of being on death's door. But yeah, he says something along the lines like they've tried chemicals, diseases, all sorts of various things, but Viltrumite cells just don't want to die.
Yeah.
So,
and that's, you know, obviously they're trying to figure out a way to kill Omni-Man, and that's why Cecil is so into keeping Mark alive and like seeing what Mark can do, because I think Cecil's assuming that Mark ultimately might be the only one that can kill Omni-Man.
Yeah. I would say that's some pretty sound reasoning. But I also did notice, you know, we talked about how Omni-Man allowed Mark to be even put in that position. So if they do find some way to have, like, find a weakness for Viltrumites, it's almost his own hubris that allows it to happen. Unless he might be like Robot and might be a few steps ahead as well. I certainly hope not for Deborah's safety, because she found his bloodied suit, which it was kind of weird that he had it hidden in that particular spot, but that's neither here nor there.
The one thing about Nolan is he doesn't seem like superhumanly smart. Like, he doesn't seem dumb. He was crafty enough to lure all the Guardians together.
True.
But, like, he also doesn't seem like his... It's not like his brain is functioning 10 steps ahead that we've seen.
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
I definitely see a lot of arrogance in him.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of arrogance.
Mm-hmm. But in that same scene where they were testing the blood and whatnot, I mentioned offline that there was a line that I thought could be interpreted multiple ways. But Ferguson says he still think blood's still the answer. And, like, I was wondering, is that a reference to Damien Darkblood? Is Damien Darkblood still the answer? I don't know. I hope so. I hope that character comes back.
Me too. As someone who's a massive Hellboy fan, like, I really do want the character that's, like, a parallel of my favorite character to come back. Yeah. But, yeah, I kind of think Ferguson just meant Mark's blood, but I think the show might have meant both.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I could just be pulling at things that aren't there, but...
Well, that's half the fun of this.
Yeah, that's true.
You said Damien Darkblood, I thought you were talking about, like, Damien Dark from the Arrowverse and his blood. I was like, are we mixing up universes here? No, it's just me.
Well, you got to imagine Robert Kirkman was definitely influenced and inspired by the same comics that, you know, inspired so many other creators that are now finally getting the opportunity to have their own creations adapted, which is just really cool to see. But the only other thing I wanted to hit on is the fact that we had this partnership with Titan, and Mark ends up being indisposed for the time being, but Titan actually does reveal himself to be duplicitous, and this was all a setup to put himself in the Kingpin position and take Machine Head's position. So
yeah, and I don't know if we covered it, but ultimately that fight breaks down with Battle Beast just wrecking everyone.
Oh yeah,
And I should just point out Battle Beast is voiced by
Michael Dorn.
Michael Dorn, yeah. Worf.
Mm-hmm.
Which, like, I thought he did an awesome job playing Battle Beast. Obviously, mm-hmm. Battle Beast didn't have a ton of lines.
Yeah.
But, like, I was like, is he just going to do his Worf voice? And, like, but he made it a complete character. And, like, I just kind of loved, like, I love the casting there.
Mm-hmm.
Because the casting kind of brings some additional gravitas to this character that, you know, we don't get a lot of. But he certainly kicks all of the ass in that scene.
Yeah. We've talked about it before, but this series really does have a star-studded cast and a very talented voice cast. But with that in mind, I would be remiss if I didn't mention, I've been noticing how Mark's high school is named Reginald Vell Johnson High. We yes. find out that the principal is Principal Winslow. Carl Winslow, Reginald Vell Johnson, is in the show voicing this character, and they've made the character look just like him.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I love that so much. Yeah. I that one got a guffaw from me.
rightly so. And then just while we're on the subject of things that, like, you know, got a laugh or an audible reaction out of us, one line that I just had to write down, when Mark's quitting his job at the Burger Mart, there's an off-screen employee that yells to the manager, he's like, there's a rat in the mayo again. And the manager's like, does it look like I care? You're the manager of a restaurant. I would think you would care about that.
Yeah, that again. Was... And that scene happens very early in the comic.
Oh, okay.
I remember, like, that happens, like, right after he gets his powers in the comic. He quits his job.
Oh, okay.
And I think they purposely delayed that scene, the quitting scene, just to contrast, like, Invincible's privilege with Titan's lack of privilege.
Right.
Because Invincible is able to quit his job and just be a superhero, where, you know, Titan's working all the time and mm-hmm. still has nothing to show for it. So,
yeah.
I just thought that was interesting that they chose to move that scene, and it worked for me.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it kind of solidifies my theory about it being the Know Your Place as well, because right before that scene, we get him in the street in his hero suit just texting Amber, which I really appreciate that they actually had, like, typos and corrections and stuff like that. That was a nice touch.
Yeah,
that's how conversation goes. But people are, like, he's getting, like, rocks and cars and shit thrown at him, and he's just kind of like, 1 second, and, like, you know, going back to his texting, so it's like... Yeah, we mentioned kind of like the privilege, and, you know, good for him that he came from a good household and whatnot, but the he is getting cocky at this point. We're it's great that he's more comfortable with his powers in regards to, like, his flight and controlling his strength and everything, but, like, now he's, like, in public just kind of like, eh, whatever, yeah, I got this, and we see what happens to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he kind of took his two steps forward, and that, by the end of this, he gets his one step back. Pretty serious step back, too.
Yeah, yeah. We got so many parallels between the two. Like, we already mentioned the dangling of a victim that you're interrogating. Like, Titan is doing all these bad things, but he actually ends up doing more endearing actions at the end. Like, there's the parallel between Invincible holding up the building and letting the people escape, where Titan is the one destroying the building, but Invincible saves these people's lives, but all he does is apologize for the state of the building that, you know, the only reason it happened is because he was having this battle. And he doesn't give them any money or anything like that. He just offers his sympathy. Titan is the one that, you know, gives them a place and money. So,
yeah.
I felt like we did... I just wanted to kind of backpedal and do talk about that opening action sequence with Titan, because I felt like we glossed over it a little bit. As gory as that final scene was, that was another thing that was, like, kind of a good example of juxtaposition. As easy as things were for Invincible, like, this action sequence was awesome to see Titan go roll in there, and as much as he's, like, destroying everybody, it's not exactly easy for him. And he's even got that sequence where, like, the guy's unloading on him with the Gatling gun, and he's forced to fling that handgun right into his forehead. Oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was intense.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't pull any punches with the animation on this one.
Yeah, yeah. Because then you got the guy that tries to shoot him at point-blank range, and the bullet just goes right back into his head.
Yeah.
Really, really interesting and dynamic ways to showcase, you know, these power sets, and just a testament to animation being able to consistently show us these big, larger-than-life action set pieces. And I just think if people have ever... I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, you obviously haven't written off animation, but anybody out there that just, like, they see something animated and they kind of overlook it, you're really just doing a disservice to yourself, because this is where you really get some of the best action and some of the best storytelling, because you don't have quite the same restraints as far as budgets go.
Tell them how you really feel, Jay Scotty.
Yeah.
I mean, based off that action scene, I think we got a good sense of his personality as well when it came to the bodyguards when he was stealing the chip. And he was like, dude, you guys get paid minimum wage. Like, do you really want to die over this right now? And you see them just all, like, shooting at the ceiling just to make look like they did their jobs while he just, like, walks out with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he doesn't kill the little kid.
Right.
When he's kicking the other gang off their turf.
That message was for you.
Right. And that sequence with when he's stealing the computer chip and he does, like, tell the guards to, like, shoot towards the ceiling, that made me think, like, how ineffective is, like, the police force in this universe, or, like, how, like, have they just, like, complacent have they become, and they just, like, rest on their laurels, where, like, anybody that just, like, you see all these shots, like, fired up into the ceiling, it's going to be pretty obvious what went down. But maybe it's just a world where people... They live with these larger-than-life characters. They don't sweat the small stuff like that. I don't know.
But they covered all that in the opening dialogue of the show.
Yeah, I was going to say, the security guard's talking about superhuman training and how pointless it is. Like,
right.
Learn how to roll away from lasers.
Yeah.
And then again, the Mars mission, where, like, Mark is supposed to kind of stay hidden because humans need a win.
Yeah, that's fair.
I think you're absolutely right that, like, security guards totally ineffectual in this world.
That's one of the big things in My Hero Academia, is that the world has evolved to a point where it's, like, it's very uncommon for somebody to not have an ability of some sort. And the main character is one of the few people who doesn't have one. It was just kind of like, holy crap, there's still a human that doesn't have one type of thing. This show kind of feels like the early stages of that, where it's like they're seeing that transition between humans and the quantity of superpowered people, and just kind of being like, well, like, they kind of ruled this place. We're just here.
Yeah.
No, yeah, it's those are great points you guys bring up, and it's just, yeah. That's the thing about like 45-minute episodes. Like, you get so much world building. We're only 5 episodes in, and we have such a keen understanding of these characters in this world that we live in.
Sure.
Did you guys have any, you know, closing thoughts or predictions for the next episode upcoming? I mean, it's a cliffhanger in the fact that we have Mark kind of, you know, clinging for life. But as I mentioned, I'm pretty confident he's going to pull through. I would say the thing I'm looking forward to most is how Amber responds to his absence and how he's going to acknowledge. Because I imagine he's going to be, you know, he's not going to come out of this without any bruises or anything like that. She's going to see that he got messed up. So
yeah,
it'll be interesting to see how they tackle that.
I just have 2 small questions.
Okay.
When Battle Beast was finishing up the fight with Invincible and they slowed down the motion of the arms going up to pound in his chest, did anybody else at that moment think, like, okay, this is where Omni Man's going to fly in and stop him?
Oh, yeah, I expected him to scream out dad or something like that for a second, yeah.
Like, when that happened, I was like, someone's going to come in, and they actually pounded his chest. Like, I jumped on the sofa, so like, holy shit, they just broke the main character. What the hell?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't expect them to do that. But, like, I was curious how Omni Man would respond, because, like, would he fly in, save Invincible, and say, I told you so? Turns out, no,
mm-hmm.
Which is, like, another strike against Omni-Man. Not that, like, he doesn't have a million strikes against him. But, yeah, it kind of just makes you wonder what his motivation was there, you know.
But as far as letting that happen, yeah.
Which brings up my next question, that if he was watching outside of the building the whole time, did he see his son, like, nearly die and then make sure that he was home early enough for his wife to get the phone call and pretend to be all surprised?
He sure did.
Because he was walking in from the sliding door when she was on the phone with Cecil.
Yep.
I was like, you bastard.
Hmm.
Yeah, he... A lot of not great dads in this episode.
Yeah.
Is it arguable that Titan is the best father in this episode?
Not totally, very arguable.
Totally yeah. Arguable, yeah.
I mean, he did get a bunch of people hurt and or killed to take power of a criminal organization, but he's the only dad that brought home ice cream.
And to be fair...
To be fair,
he was killing, like, gang organizations and drug dealers, too, so it's like,
yeah.
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 And he did tell them to stop, so...
Like, low-key, Titan best dad.
Yeah.
Father of the year, Titan.
Well, as much as I talked about the fallout between Amber and Invincible's relationship, you gotta wonder, now that Titan is in this position... And Invincible is going to remember what he did to him. Is Titan going to be the big bad of the season? Because they sure as hell made me like him quite a bit in just this episode. We've also got Robot out there. So, I mean, Battle Beast is still out there. Obviously, Nolan Omni-Man is a very menacing presence. I really don't know where they're going to go. I think we have, you know, 3 episodes left, as we're led to believe. It could go anywhere.
If we have the parallel of Invincible being the guy in the sky and Titan being like the street level person, I could see them collaborating a lot.
Mm.
Where it's like Invincible is like, I don't like what you do, but we need to work together from time to time. Which is the same thing that was kind of like what happened in Luke Cage, which is kind of like, well, I can't stop these people from doing what they do on the street, so I'm just gonna supervise it.
Like I said, it'll be interesting to see where they go with it, but I imagine that Invincible's feeling pretty jaded, so if they do find a resolution and an understanding, I'd give them praise for it, for taking a different approach, but my expectation is that Invincible's going to have an axe to grind.
He's feeling the mode.
Yeah.
You know, not to drag the episode open, again, but I should just point out that we see Invincible kind of loses cool in this episode during that fight too.
Yep. Yeah.
He screams like, "I'll fucking kill all of you," or something.
Yeah, he's like, "You're all done," or like, and then he.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who's next? And that's when he goes up against Battle Beast. I want to keep calling him Battle Cat, but.
I love that character design. I don't know if that's from the comics, but like.
Yeah, when I was looking it up, there was more comic panels than there was like scenes from the show.
Okay.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I just like, yeah, from Amazon, I knew the character was Battle Beast, and because I was like, that voice is familiar. Who's doing this voice? Mm-hmm. And it was Michael Dorn. But yeah, like, obviously later in the comics than I ever read to. And now that I'm watching the show, I don't want to read the comics and spoil myself.
Yeah, right.
So I'm like, between seasons, maybe I can read some of the comics.
Yeah.
But I don't want to ruin the next season. So now I'm in that position that I think a lot of Game of Thrones fans
are in. I was just
going
to say,
like,
yeah.
Wait for the TV show to finish, then read the books.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that's the way I'm going to go. But it really has inspired me to want to pick up the comic source material. So just a testament to what an excellent adaptation it is and just quality entertainment. We already said it. It's a great time to be a fan of just fandom stuff in general, but especially animation with series like this coming out all the time. All right, well, that's going to do it for another episode of Animation Deliberation. Thanks for tuning in and listening. If you've got any feedback for us, you can hit us up at animationdeliberationpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at jscottforreal. And please follow Stranded Panda, everything that network's doing, strandedpanda.com. You can join the Stranded Panda Army. There is a family of shows there that are all geared towards this geek fandom content, the Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast, Star Trek Universe podcast, as well as the Star Wars Universe podcast, and Bingers Assemble, Pandavision, and the Superhero Ethics podcast. So please take a look at all the wonderful things we're doing there and support the awesome endeavors there. That's going to do it for me. You guys got anything you want to plug?
Stranded Panda Trivia and After Dark on Twitch every Wednesday at twitch.tv/strandedpandatv. You can usually find all three of us hanging out there after dark. I guess I haven't been there as much lately due to a series of complications, but I'll get back on the horse. Other than that, there's the Facebook group, which Scotty mentioned, but very active group of people, a lot of talk of MCU stuff, but trying to get a little more of the Invincible talk going on Fridays.
Yes.
Through all the Falcon and Winter Soldier debate.
Yeah, you need a machete to cut through that. But Zuhair, say your line.
Stay whelmed.